Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
104.5 The Zone, hitting the links with you on a Saturday morning. This is Talking Golf with Virgil Herring on 104.5 The Zone.
Good morning. It's time to talk a little golf. And you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Got another great show lined up for us today. KK Ray is going to join us at the end of the show to go over a recent article that Bryson DeChambeau had on PGAtour.com. Not about slamming putters into the green, but about the cutting edge training that he's doing for his mind. So she'll be joining us at the end of the show. Dennis Sales will be joining us at the Orca Driving Range at the bottom of the hour to help us with our game. And as always, at 7:15, Jim Nugent will be writing Monday's headlines on Saturday morning. But I figured today would be a special day to get our game started with possibly the most well-rounded voice for what it takes to play at a high level. He's played major Division I college golf, played on multiple tours, including many top finishes on what was then the web. It was maybe the nationwide tour then. And now as a teacher at Butch Harmon Floridian, Nashville native Matt Gallant. Matt, how are you today, buddy?
I'm good, Virgil. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Well, I know that you've kind of touched it all when it comes to this game of golf. Now that you're sticking your toe into the teaching world, but you know, as a great player, and I have personal experience of knowing both the player and the caddy, easily the best caddy I've ever even thought about having. What is it that you feel like you have learned through your play and as a caddy that is making teaching golf to the everyday golfer and the best players so gratifying?
You know, I really like watching people get better. I mean, it's that simple in at all aspects of golf, whatever, if it's mental, you know, technical, just playing, having fun. I mean, it's just fun to watch people enjoy playing golf and help grow the game, you know, however I can.
When you watch at the beginning part of teaching golf, are there any particular things that you would pass on to the listeners about that what you see at the beginning of learning it that would help them the most when it comes to getting off to a good start so that they can enjoy the game quicker? Because although I believe that this game is not easy to play on TV, it's not that difficult to play enjoyably. What are some of your fundamentals that you like to pass on to your clients?
If we're talking about more of the high handicap beginner golfers, this is actually what I found to be the harder lessons for me, coming from where I came from, as you know, trying to get back to the basics of it. I think most people struggle with just being patient and learning the posture, setup, alignment, just the small stuff that can take your game, you know, to the next level right from the beginning. I mean, I think if you don't get those first parts right, you really kind of struggle with it from there on. And then, you know, down the road, you end up always kind of battling those same things. And it's hard to really move forward with your progression with your mechanics until you get the first part down. But nobody wants to really take the time to kind of get that part. They just want to go ahead and try to hit it hard as they can and get upset for the reason why it's not going where they thought it should go. And, you know, so it's a challenge to just be patient and just learn those basics. And then down the, you know, soon after that, you can kind of go and do whatever you want with it.
It's so true. Like, one of the things that I would tell you that in my experience of teaching for a long time is that the lesson that you give the beginner is almost always the lesson you end up giving to the tour player, because the tour player hasn't forgotten how to swing a golf club. He just doesn't realize that maybe he's gotten an inch too far from it. The ball's got a little bit too far forward. You know, maybe he's getting a little too soft in his spine. Maybe just a little slumped over at address. It's kind of funny how It comes full circle, and as you get much better, it always comes back to the simple fundamentals, no doubt.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's, you know, golf is like a extremely high level of mechanics sandwich with, you know, the bread is just the basic fundamentals around it. You always kind of come, you start with that, you know, that outer layer, and you always come back to the same layer no matter what level you're at. It is true.
Well, yeah, you're very fortunate also to be at a place where the best players in the world go to work on their game, Dustin Johnson, Fowler, Koepka, and many others. And as you get an up-close and personal view of it, I would love to hear your take on what it is that you see that Dustin and Brooks have in their game that you didn't have then or now that would have made a difference in your playing career, but you look forward to passing on in your teaching career.
Yeah, I think people would be surprised how simple these guys keep it. You know, BJ's obviously an unbelievable athlete, as well as Brooks, and these guys just, they know what they do well, and they don't overcomplicate it, and they have really, really short memories. You know, I think DJ might have the shortest memory of anyone I've ever seen. I mean, he doesn't, you know, I've heard, it's amazing listening to Butch tell some of the stories about him. I mean, once he three-putted that putt at Chambers Bay, he basically never talked about it ever again, and somebody asked him about it, and he said, why would everyone talk about that? That wasn't good. Let's move on. And so he, you know, then he wins the next year. I mean, how crazy is that? I mean, you know what level you got to be to come back the next year and just win right away. I mean, a lot of people with that would kind of take you down. So these guys just keep it simple, and they don't overcomplicate it. And the instructors that work with them that I've seen, you know, go right along the same lines with them. I mean, if there's stuff that needs to be worked on, they hit it. But I mean, generally, it's basically just kind of keeping them between the lines.
It is interesting as we're listening to Matt Glahn, who is an instructor, the Butch Harmon Floridian. I find it's fascinating because in some ways, to be great, you have to have a level of perfection and work ethic, and maybe a little bit of OCD, a little bit of obsessive compulsive when it comes to this game. But then when you get to that top level, like DJ and Koepka are, you have to learn that what got you there won't keep you there, and you got to have that short memory to forget the negatives, because golf provides plenty of negative. What is it that you have learned? Because you had your last year, you had your first two professional victories as a player. What have you learned, possibly from caddying for the great players to playing great, that you're passing on? What is it about that part of the game that you? Because everybody wants to be awesome, and you want to take those bad moments hard, so you work harder the next time around. But at the end of the day, sometimes you just can't work harder. You got to forget. What would you pass on?
Something to look at to help you keep improving.
That too. Or, you know, I know that when golf is creates this place where we brood over our failures, and we don't spend a whole lot of time celebrating our victories because they are expected. Well, we're really good. I practice all the time. I should win all the time. So we don't celebrate our victories, but man, we're quick to punish ourselves if we underperform, miss a putt, poor chip, what have you. I guess that was my point, what is it that you would be passing on when it comes to coping with the failures?
Yeah, that's a good question. I see that at every level too. I mean, I think what I would say is just enjoy it. You know, you put in the work, and if you get to a tournament where you play well and you do some good stuff, I mean, focus on that and enjoy it, because, you know, it could be over before you know it, and all of a sudden you look back and you're wishing you had what you know, you were at where you were, and instead of getting upset that you're not where you weren't. So it's like, just be in the moment and enjoy what you're doing, and don't beat yourself up. I mean, the game's going to do that for you. If you just kind of accept what happens and do your best and have fun with it. You know, I think a lot of the new what I've seen also is a lot of this new research, and I've learned so much in the last year, as, you know, going down the road I've been going, is you don't have to be as perfect as you think you got to be. It's great to practice towards that, but there has to be a level of acceptance. And when you're playing, that most of these guys don't hit mean, not most, all these guys don't hit all the shots they want to hit, and they just know how to play the game. So I think just really enjoying it, get out there, enjoy playing the game, start, get the basics down, and then kind of go build your own swing and trust your own game. You know, I think it can be, at least for me, I mean, I definitely overcomplicated things, and when I got to a level where I was close to making it, I decided that I wasn't good enough and started trying to rebuild it, you know, and basically didn't really know what I was doing and kind of got lost. So I think keeping an eye on what you know you can do and how you do it, and a good teacher around you and some basic stuff can help you stay more on course, and then you can just kind of get out of your own way and enjoy it.
Well, I'm so happy for you. I know that the game of golf loves you and you love the game of golf, and I know sometimes you wonder why you're not playing and maybe but at the end of the day, the game of golf loves you and what you've done for it, and I'm looking forward to seeing where your teaching career goes. I know where your playing talents are, and I know where your all of your care is. So I'm super excited for you in your future, and obviously, you know that if you need anything from me, buddy, just reach out.
Hey, B, it's always great to talk to you, even this early in the morning. I probably jumbled up a lot of my words there, but I hope it came across as something useful.
you did a great job, Matt. Look forward to catching up with you when you get back to Nashville, and best luck to you.
Yeah, buddy. I'll see you soon.
All right, man. All right, when we return, Jim Nugent's going to join us, and we are going to talk about many, many things again that have nothing to do with golf. So stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Welcome back, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. If you want to hit me up on Twitter, I am at Virgil Torspin. It's at this time every Saturday morning we go to write Monday's headlines on Saturday morning with the founder of Global Golf Post, Jim Nugent. Nuge, how are you today, buddy?
Virgil, I'm good. Thank you very much for having me on today.
My pleasure. Well, for the fourth week in a row, the rules and the rules that aren't called and the rules that are called become our first topic of conversation. One of the funniest memes I've seen in a long time occurred not long after the Riviera tournament ended, in which they said that before J.B. Holmes teed off on Sunday, he found out that his wife was pregnant, and when he putted out on 18, he got a chance to meet his two-year-old son. I thought it was pretty funny. But pace of play with Brooks Koepka teeing it up about 2 weeks prior to that, with they're afraid to make any comments on it, and then the ridiculously slow play of J.B. Holmes, and he's not the only one, but I mean, it was obvious that it's painstaking. What's your current take on what's going on with the pace of play, the lack of judgment on it, and what are we going to do about it?
Well, it's twofold. First of all, you know, the fundamental driving force behind rules modernization by the USGA and the RNA was to speed up the game. It was to cause people to spend less time on the golf course. And yet what we saw on Sunday with J.B. Holmes was the exact opposite of that. He was, you know, as he has been, flagrant in his determination to play at his own pace. And he really doesn't care what anybody thinks about it. There was a great line that I heard from our Ron Green on Sunday. Apparently, Ricky Fowler observed, or no, Roy McIlroy observed last year at one point in time, that the only player on the golf course slower than J.B. Holmes is his caddy. That's a bad cocktail.
Wow. That's interesting. So you are at the AGAGA annual meeting, and obviously they are the beacon of light for pace of play. What did you glean from them that maybe our listeners could learn about when it comes to speeding up play, but what the tour could maybe pay attention to?
It's the USGA annual meeting.
Oh, the USGA, I'm sorry.
There is a palpable frustration among USGA loyalists about the silence coming from the headquarters of the PGA Tour and the leadership of the PGA Tour. They not only had a voice in the whole process of rules modernization, they had an outsized voice, which makes sense. They're the guys that play for a living are the most visible players, and we need them to understand the rules and to play by the rules. And yet we've had, you know, these snafus from the very beginning, and yet there's been silence from the leadership of the PGA Tour and from PGA Tour headquarters. And meanwhile, the players, be it Adam Scott or Ricky Fowler, are chirping in the media about how dumb this is or how unfair this is or what a bad idea this is. And I think that the USGA would very much like Jay Monahan to step up and say to his boys, hey, grow up, put a muzzle in it. It's not that big a deal. Let's move on and let's just quit chirping about it. So that's kind of the take that I've gotten in the time that I've been at the USGA annual meeting in San Antonio.
Interesting. And then, of course, yesterday on the LPGA Tour, there became an implosion between Jeff Shackelford and Brandel, and the Golf Channel itself was very heavy on this backstopping scenario between Araya Jatanagarn and Amy Olson. On a shot that it looked like they were almost scheming to leave Aria's ball right by the hole so that it, just in case Amy's shot came in a little hot and it hit it, it would benefit her, which is almost laughable. But backstopping is not the first time we've talked about this as a problem. But this is has grown tentacles, and it's a very interesting story. What's your take on how the social media just piled on this thing and the LPGA's reaction to it?
I think the LPGA's reaction to it was appropriate and proper, and the people that are roasting these players in social media not only don't know the facts, they don't know the players, and they don't know the situation. Amy Olson is one of the fastest players in golf, and she she and her partner playing the 18th hole, they were forced to wait 10 minutes because Michelle Wee got a ruling ahead of them. And, you know, that kind of upsets Amy's natural rhythm. After Tanagarn hit her third shot up on the 18th hole and had a long way to go to walk up and mark it, Amy Olson shook her off and said, no, don't bother. The ball was not in her way. She plays fast. She hit her chip shot. She missed the shot. She missed her line completely. Her ball hit Jutanikarn's ball and stopped, and it was traveling at a pretty high speed, so she got a break there. And she rolled in her putt for birdie, and then the two girls kind of fist bumped and laughed at each other. This was not backstopping. And backstopping, quite frankly, is something that's become almost a Dallas-like grassy knoll conspiracy theory in the social media. It's really a non-story, but it gives a lot of people something to yell about in the social world. And unfortunately, two pretty good citizens on the LPGA are getting roasted over it, and it's really unfair.
Yeah, it is kind of once I saw it, I was like, wow, that. But I didn't see the whole story, and I only saw like the wave off, the hit the ball, and then that little high five. Like they compressed it to like 17 seconds, and I was like, "Ooh, that didn't look good." And then obviously the story comes out that it was nothing like that. That's the evil part of social media. Pretty sad.
If you watch the video with no sound, you might infer that something was amiss there. But if you listen to what the players said, if you read the transcripts from the press conference, if you talk to Amy Olson, you'll find out that there was no intent there. She'll tell you she hit a really poor shot. She was way offline with her chip, and it hit the ball. But, you know, if the social media people don't have something to moan and gripe about, they're really crabby, so they had to do something to make their existence known yesterday.
Yeah. Well, finally, 7 minutes in, we get to talk a little golf, World Golf Championship in Mexico, and we got basically a dream leaderboard. Dustin Johnson leading by two over Kuchar and McIlroy. Fleetwood makes his first appearance. He's in fourth with Sergio, who's got some repair to do, no pun intended, and a host of other great players. Tiger, T8. Molinari makes his first appearance, T13 right now, and Justin Thomas lingering around, T16. This looks like it's going to be a great week on a really fun and exciting golf course to watch him play.
You know, I think you make a good point there. This is a fun golf course. When you consider the altitude and combine that with the strength that some of these players have, it presents all kinds of options, but it presents all kinds of challenges as well. Yeah, some of them are hitting irons off the tees, try and move the ball around a little bit, but it's fun to see. It's not a great golf course, but it's a challenging golf course. And I think the players, at least the guys at the top of the leaderboard, are enjoying it because they're presented with lots of options. They can do lots of different things, and it's been fun to watch for the first 2 days.
It seems like that's the piece that we love the most about the tour golf is when the best players in the world have to decipher between four good options. And when they have all of those good options, it always leads to a little bit of doubt that maybe they chose either the not the safest one or not the most aggressive one. And to watch the best of the best make the decisions knowing where their game currently is and allows them to take it to the next level for that particular week. Those are the kind of events that we love. I guess that's why they love Pinehurst so much, is because they're setting up over of a shot and they're like, well, I could hit 3 wood. I could hit a 7 iron. I could hit a pitching wedge. I can hit a flop shot. I mean, I got a bunch of shots, and not one of them I couldn't hole, but not one of them are guaranteed to stay on the green. And that's what makes it so fun to watch.
It really does, you know, and then, you know, in this particular situation, when you factor in the altitude and guys having to really think clearly, okay, what exactly is this distance and how far do I need to carry it? It adds an element that rarely comes into play on the PGA Tour.
Yeah, no doubt about it. How about, what do you think about that unbelievable shot that Tiger Woods hit yesterday on the ninth hole? That's vintage Tiger, and just, I mean, that was really... That might be the best shot we're going to see in 2019.
Is he in the hospital this morning having back surgery?
I don't think so.
God, I don't think I could get myself into that physical position with my back, and I haven't had any surgery. He's had a bunch, and somehow that was really a thing of beauty. To how many guys can cut extensive side spin a 9 iron, and how many guys can do it out of a bunker? That was vintage Tiger.
Yeah, that was so beautiful. It just kind of just lets me, like, to me, I'm very impressed with where his swing is, and like, there isn't any part of his game that even looks even remotely shaky. He's just not the most dominant player in the game. He's just one of about 18 guys that could win at any given time. But he looks really good, and although I don't see him winning this week, it is fun to see Tiger in a situation right now where he's healthy, and he's starting to play golf like with the artist that he used to be instead of the machine-like perfectionist that he ended up being. This is pretty exciting.
Yeah, you're right. He's not as good as he was. He's still very, very good. He's still very elite. The boys caught up to him out there, and he's not the longest, and he's not necessarily the best. But you're right, on any given week, on a golf course where he's won a few times, let's just say Augusta National, he's one to keep an eye on.
Yeah, no question about it. Well, how do you see the headlines reading on Monday morning, Nuge?
Well, you know, the heart, I think most golfers are pulling for Rory. They'd like to see him back. Break through, get back in the leaderboard, get back into the elite part of the game. But how do you ever bet against Dustin Johnson when he's got a 36-hole lead and hasn't made a bogey? And so, whereas I usually go with my heart, this week it's the head, Virgil. It's the headline at Global Golf Post on Monday says, DJ! I just don't think he's going to cough up the lead.
With one of his greatest quotes ever, which was, "This golf course really suits me. It's really tight, but it is tree-lined, so it works out good for me." Yes, DJ at his finest. Nuge, how can my listeners get a hold of the Global Golf Post and Global Golf Post Plus?
You can get a free subscription to our Monday digital edition at globalgolfpost.com. We'll tell you everything you need to know about what happened last week. We'll make you the smartest golfer in your foursome. And you can get a subscription for just $7 a month to our new product, Global Golf Post Plus, where you'll encounter some of the finest golf journalism anywhere on planet golf, globalgolfpost.com.
Nuge, you're the man. Thank you very much for taking the time to come on my show. Look forward to having you on next week, buddy.
Cheers, Virgil. Thank you.
All right, we return. We're headed to the Orca Driving Range, so stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Nobody said it was easy. Welcome back, and you are listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. It's at this time every Saturday morning we make the turn and decide it's a better idea to go to the range, the Orca Driving Range, where I bring in the best teachers in the country to help us with our game, and today is no different. From Dallas, Texas, really one of the best golf coaches in the world. And he's left-handed, which really makes him rock. From Dallas, Texas, Dennis Sales. Dennis, how are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, Virgil. How about yourself?
I'm doing wonderful. We got two things today. One is you're going to be the first person ever on my show to discuss the fairway bunker shot, but more importantly, the fairway bunker shot we saw Tiger Woods hit yesterday, which was, you know, his second greatest fairway bunker shot. Well, maybe third fairway greatest fairway bunker shot of his entire career. But if for somebody who has probably the 10 greatest golf shots in the history of the game, and maybe the 10 worst also, but at the end of the day, the bunker shot that he hit on 9 yesterday was amazing. But not that we're going to be able to help the average listener slice a 9-iron from 130 out of a fairway bunker, but let's step through the fundamentals of playing a fairway bunker shot first, and then we'll add some curve to the ball second.
Okay. I would say one of the fundamentals would be, you know, making sure that we have some stability in the base to be able to control low point a little bit more effectively. And then I would also kind of start to add just a little bit more, maybe the ball just a touch more back of where the player would normally have it, just to kind of ensure that contact becomes just a touch more cleaner, so that the chances of, you know, hitting that fat shot get a little bit more eliminated. Those are the two big pieces for me. And I might even throw in, you know, maybe putting my the hands down on the grip a touch to kind of match how much my feet have kind of dug into the ground. So everything kind of, I would say, kind of changes a little bit depending on the texture of the sand as well.
Yeah, I think that that's very true about the texture of the sand, because it definitely plays a teeny bit of a role that most people don't really spend much time thinking of, as they mostly just trying to get it out. But I think it's important for people to recognize the fact that the number one reason, in my opinion, that people struggle with the fairway bunker shot is they don't stabilize their feet, because there's going to be, and this is a fairway bunker shot, we're going to create a lot of ground forces, and the sand will give, and when the sand gives, we're almost guaranteed to hit it fat. Talk to us about the keys to getting in the sand correctly. That's very important.
What do you mean by the keys of getting into the sand? You're talking about more like your feet?
Yes, correct. That's correct.
Yeah, so let's just start by saying that the bunker is flat and that the player is not and on any kind of slope. At least that makes it a little easier for listeners to understand. So if it's pretty flat, I would say that some of the keys to the feet interacting with the sand better would be ensuring that if you're looking at it, and the same thing as if you're at the beach with your feet, is that there's equal amounts of distribution, or you would say in terms of the depth between the balls of the feet and the heels. I think a lot of times when you see players, and I would say the higher the handicap player, if you're kind of paying attention to their feet, their feet won't be evenly distributed in the sand. And then as you start to get the better players, they have a better sense of proprioception of where their feet are in their sand, so they kind of balance themselves out in terms of the digging aspect a lot better. And I would also add that I would say that it would be more of an imperative for the majority of golfers as well to kind of feel a touch more flaring of the feet. And a lot of people kind of get all up in arms about that, but the flaring of the feet is more of a hip femur action than actually a foot action, which helps the pelvis as well.
I like that. We're listening to Dennis Sales, Dennis Sales Golf out of Dallas, Texas. Dennis, when you start throwing in the real intricate pieces of moving the golf ball left to right or right to left out of there, especially like Tiger's shot, which was a pretty dramatic, almost call it a slice, but yet you move the ball back in your stance and you got all kinds of D plane action, which makes it even harder to cut the golf ball from that place. What is it that the average listener can do if they really need to kind of get it, you know, out of the fairway bunker, but make it move around a tree or something of the like? What would you have? Just let's talk about the fade shot. We'll just use Tiger shot as the purpose here. What do you want to do to help people curve that ball out of there?
Well, I would say that the number one piece that I still see that golfers come out for lessons and stuff is that they truly have no idea what really makes the ball curve. And why some of the shots that they have. So I would say the first thing is kind of what you said earlier, is the D plane. As complex as it is, I think a lot of instruction tries to kind of dumb it down too much. I think you got to understand that the golf swing and just impact alone is a complex subject, in that anytime you try to dumb something down, it becomes incomplete. And at the same time, now, the golfer is going to be faced with many different shots that he's going to try to curve, intentionally or unintentionally, and he's got to be able to reverse engineer the shot correctly so that he can apply the right fix. So I would start off by, you know, starting to get people to understand some of the complexities in curving a golf ball, and then try to simplify the concepts for them so they can better diagnose their action. So as it starts to relate to, you know, again, moving the ball back in the stance and try to hit that big slice, now you'd have to start to aim at the base of the plane so that the path is way left of the target, and then they've got to understand that the path is going to create the curvature as it is in relation to the face. So when I'm teaching my, you know, 7-8-year-old kids about the D plane, just kind of make it really simple for them and get them to understand that. Again, you know, when we're looking at the initial starting direction, the reference piece would be is where is the face to the target, okay? And then it would be two targets, right? It's the flag, and then where do I want the ball to start? And then from there, the path can be either left of that point, in line of that point, or right of that point. And the ball will curve on the center strike pretty much opposite of the path. So if you get the face a little left of what Tiger did of his target, and then the path more left, and depending on how much more left that path is to where the face is, that creates the curve. And you start explaining that to the kids, and then they quickly grasp the concept, and it gives them a better understanding when they're out practicing on their own to self-correct, and at the same time, to become creative so that they can go ahead and make the ball dance.
Buddy, that is about as good as I've had on the show in a long time. That was magnificent, Dennis. Thank you.
Thanks.
The next thing I want you to go over, you've had some recent posts with Cameron Champ, Rory McIlroy, and Tiger Woods with the hashtag secret sauce. We're not going to let it be a secret here. What's the secret sauce that the best players, those three being included into that bunch, that they're providing that you see that the people can learn from as they watch it, but maybe add into their game?
Ooh, you're putting me on the spot, huh? I would start off by, again, so Sasha had an article that was posted on golf.com, and then that some of the stuff that he kind of talked about in that article is things that I believe, again, trying to make the hand path a little longer, trying to feel a little bit more back bend at the top to get a little bit more extension. You see that all in those guys. A little bit of the lordosis in the spine as well, kind of looking at it from that face-on view. And then at the same time trying to, a lot of the mentality is just taking it back low and slow. And even Sasha kind of touched upon it, but I learned that about 4 or 5 years ago. I have my speed teaching mentor, Ben Jackson from Ben Jackson Golf up in my hometown, up in Rhode Island. It was something that I learned from him about 4 years ago when I was able to finally get up there to go see him. He is probably, in my opinion, by far, the best speed guy in the country. And you know me, I like to do a lot of research. And stuff, but this guy is quietly stayed under the radar, worked with long drive guys for about 25 years that nobody's ever heard of. And we do a lot of speed training, a lot of tempo training, things along that nature. But I would definitely say some more extension. So many people train in flexion at the top of the golf swing, trying to maintain too much spine angle. And then, you know, they're not really able to create the catapult effect that you would see kind of with how the pelvis tucks and it extends to the finish with some of the long drive guys. The three guys that I posted, and any of you start to look at a little bit of the cross, track and field stuff, the guys who are throwing the hammer, the guys who are doing the high jump, the guys who are throwing the javelin, the discus. You see a lot of the similarities with those guys absolutely launching those things, right? But the pelvis is tucking, there's this extension. So we're not really kind of promoting the reverse T either, but we're trying to have some balance that in that sense there to the finish to try to create a little bit more of that catapult.
I'm with you on that. I think that one of the most commonly misunderstood pieces of the backswing and is that like that, well, it was like from the thoracic spine to the top of the head extension. And most people don't buy into that, but it's when you watch it from the right angle, man, Jack had it. All the greats had it, but I mean, it's interesting, and you can really see it in Jack Nicklaus, Arnold Palmer. And certainly now, when you look at this into this era, obviously Greg Norman had a Tom Watson hat, but now you got like Champ, Tiger, McIlroy, Dustin Johnson probably is as visible as anybody as well. So I mean, super important for people to understand.
It's different, right? It's a different concept. It's not really discussed, I guess you could say, in the magazines and on TV much, right? But again, if you go look at 3D and you start to understand that kind of stuff, it's there, yep. Right? So I guess it kind of goes a little bit against the traditional, you know, put the club across your shoulders, put the club inside on the ground inside your right heel, get your shoulders to go over your feet, and you're just turning in flexion. It's hard to be able to hit it out of your shadow that way. And even if you look at some of the really long guys on tour, they have the most of it. And then you look at the guys who are the shortest, they don't have it as much.
Very true. Dennis, thank you so much for taking the time to come on my show. Best of luck to you, buddy, and look forward to having you on again really soon.
Perfect. Thanks so much, buddy.
My pleasure. Man, Dennis Sales, one of the best in the country right there. When we return, we're going to delve into this article that Bryson DeChambeau had on PGAtour.com about how to take your mental game to the next level. So stick around. You're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. Time to finish strong, and you're listening to Talking Golf with Virgil Herring here on 104.5 The Zone. As I like to do regularly on my show, I like to take a deep dive into the brain. And recently in this week's PGAtour.com article, Bryson DeChambeau had an article written about the neurofeedback work that he's doing. And it's most recently done, and it's played a huge role in his 5 wins in his last 14 events. And I do find it fascinating that with all the information out there about neurofeedback and the neurofeedback training, it seems to be also this somewhat of a taboo subject because maybe people don't understand about it very much and they don't want to mess with the brain. But unfortunately, it's what the best athletes all across the world are doing to get a little sneaking edge on the field. And to discuss what Bryson DeChambeau is doing, I've brought in the expert in our area, KK Ray from Tennessee Neurofeedback. KK, how are you today?
Good morning, Virgil. I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful, and thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to help us understand what Bryson DeChambeau is doing when it comes to neurofeedback and operant conditioning. Talk to us real quick about the things that he is doing and how effective they are in helping people take their game to the next level.
Yeah, this whole sector is coming at us all at the speed of light. So it's hard to even pull apart what he's doing. I did a little bit of research on it, and you really can't tell exactly the things that I did see he's doing for sure. Is heart rate variability, which any of us can do, and it's fabulous. There's a couple apps out there that I really like. And then he's doing, in the neurofeedback sector, what we call theta-beta ratio training. And that will work for somebody that has slow beta waves. And I know that's real scientific, but basically when you start to think, your brain slows down instead of speeds up. And that's classic ADD. So it's working for him because he's keeping his focus in the narrow range, because that's his issue. So I don't know that necessarily what he's specifically doing for neurofeedback is it's not, you know, one size fits all. The heart rate variability training and meditation, those both are excellent one size fits all things.
I do find it very fascinating that I tell you, one of my favorite things is, like, anytime somebody comes to me wanting to work on their mental game and we start talking about breathing, like, coach, I didn't come here to see you for you to tell me how to breathe.
Yeah.
But the ability to be able to control your breathing and your heart rate is integral in also allowing the brain to be at its optimum performance state while competing at anything, let alone in this particular endeavor called golf. Talk to us about that and the importance of it and the ability to control your heart rate and how it works.
Yeah, so there's an app called Breathing Zone. You don't need anything besides your phone. And what we're doing, just think of it's called vagal tone. So think of muscle tone. That, when you're thinking of that, how strong are your muscles? How hard do you work them out? And heart rate variability teaches the vagal, as I understand it, it gives you the ability to switch from fight, flight, and freeze or stress position to relax. So that's parasympathetic, staying in more of the parasympathetic side of your nervous system. And the breathing and practicing your breathing allows you to do that more quickly, to come out of stress out or even notice that you're stressed, because many of us are just walking around with every muscle in our body tense and don't even realize it because we're requiring so much of ourselves every day.
I did find it interesting that they're saying that the best athletes are taking about 12 to 18 breaths a minute. And even the best ones are trending more toward the 14, 13, 12 than the 17, 18 group.
Mm-hmm.
I tried that. I just tried to where am I? I am not in that range. That's really humbling. But
yeah.
I just can't. It's so hard for me to fathom that people don't grasp it. But yet when we sit back and think about what, on a more higher level, like what the Navy SEALs are doing and what the special forces, they spend a lot of time working on breathing. And it's like, why doesn't the world want to accept the higher end of brain training?
You know, that's really interesting to me too, because even the word trauma, people run from in our world, in the mental health world. And so anything less than that, I think that people, I don't know, I'm probably not making as much sense as I'd like to, but I think it's a stigma that we've got to keep pushing back on. And even in my career, you know, I've been in it 20 years. When I started, we didn't even think the brain could change. And so, I mean, I would watch people day in and day out get better, but neuroscience said, no, there's no ability to change the brain. And now we know so much more. I just think mainstream, culture doesn't want to admit that there's things going on mentally that could be improved. And then there's also, in your world, the peak performance world and elite athlete world, nobody wants to let their secret out of what they're doing that works. So you've got two things that are working against, bringing it to light.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, if you've been listening to the show any time since October, you know how much I've talked about neurofeedback. And I think it was 2 weeks ago, I had multiple emails talking about how much this has helped their life, and these are clients here and people here in Nashville, that this is not just for high-end performance athletics. It's also for daily life. And for all of my listeners who have reached out to me, thank you, KK, for all the what your company is doing for our area. Real quickly, hand out your contact information so people out there that are struggling, not just with their golf game, but with anxiety, trauma, stress, anything, how can they get in touch with you, KK, to help change their direction?
Yeah, it's thank you. TNNFB, TennesseeNeurofeedback.com. So TNNFB. And an easier way to look at it, real quick, Virgil, is just it's dysregulation of the brain. It's not a big deal. It's just your brain's not firing right, and we just bring it back into normal range. So from dysregulation to regulation, and that helps everybody.
I can't stress it enough. And I've recently been watching many people struggle. And it's out there for everybody, and anybody who's denying it is denying the truth. Yeah. That is one of the biggest keys, is it is about taking dysregulation to regulation. And please, if you feel like anything's going on, please reach out to KK here, and I'll post this information again on my site. KK, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join me, and I hope you have a great day.
Yeah, thank you, Virgil. Appreciate it. Take care.
My pleasure. Well, thank you for making us part of your Saturday morning, because without you, there is no talking golf. For all of my guests, Jim Nugent, KK Ray, Dennis Sales, and Matt Gallant, thank you. So have a great Saturday. Stay safe out there.